Hi, welcome to Cloud Cover. My name is Steve Marks.
And I'm Ryan Dunn.
Hey, we got a great show this week. We're going to be talking about using Silverlight in Windows Azure. Mm-hmm. We're also going to cover the news as normal, and we'll end up with a tip on how to use Fiddler to debug and inspect your request to the storage. Okay, Steve, let's tee it up.
First thing we got is Dallas.
Yeah, big announcement at WPC was that Dallas is actually a CTP3, and we're going to have it released to web, or RTW as they call it, which is essentially in production, mm-hmm. At the end of the year, or by the end of the year. So Q4 CY, calendar year, 20 year. Yeah.
Yep.
Instead of fiscal year, right?
So that's really cool. Looking forward to that. There's some new content provider partners as mm-hmm. well who were announced, like LexisNexis, Wolfram Alpha, the Environmental Agency, European Environmental Agency.
Which I assume that means you can get a mashup of all the polluters in Europe.
Yep, that's exactly what that's for. All right, moving right along to understanding Windows Azure Storage Billing, bandwidth, transactions, and capacity. Oh my.
I wonder what this is about.
I'm glad you asked, Ryan, because it is about how you can understand Windows Azure Storage Billing, including bandwidth, transactions, and capacity.
No kidding. That wasn't clear.
Yeah, I know. It's a little... The title really sold it short. But this is on the Windows Azure Storage blog. We'll have a link, of course. This is a long post, so we're not going to really cover everything that's in here.
It's approximately 27 pages.
It is. It's something like that. But it's got... both from the high level, hey, here's what stuff costs, mm-hmm. Down to, as you get like way down towards the bottom, it has some things about the overhead in like, so a blob container, here's how the actual data that you use is computed. So that's pretty cool. I think even further down, or maybe it's a little further up, there's also some information about transactions and, it's right here. So depending on where a transaction fails, if it fails, there's sort of rules about whether it's counted as a transaction right. that you actually pay for or not. So, I mean, this is it. This is sort of everything you need to know if you want to get really specific about
this is the rules engine for billing. This is great.
Yep.
You'll notice that only one person has actually made it through that entire post.
Yep, and he left a comment. This is exactly the information I was looking for to help me estimate my monthly costs. Thank you for providing so much detail. That sounds phony.
Yeah.
I think that's Brad. I think Brad on the storage team wrote a blog post and then signed in as Kevin and said, like, oh, this is great.
Don't you have to be authenticated now to comment?
Yeah.
So it's
got to be someone named Kevin because they actually validate that your first name is what you type in.
For sure they do.
This is actually great. Even people who haven't commented here have said things on Twitter and whatever. Yeah. I tweeted a link to this and a lot of people replied and said, said pretty much what Kevin said, which is this is really useful for people who really want to know what everything's going to cost. Turns out, actually, I read through this whole thing and found out that while a few tiny things are different than what I thought about, like authentication failures don't count as a transaction and things right. like that, like some things that I hadn't really thought through, overall, nothing changed really my understanding of how things worked.
Yeah.
Even the overhead that's there, all the overhead is pretty small. So don't feel like you have to go understand all this really detailed to get an accurate estimate. But if you're one of those people who really wants to know all those details, they're all here.
Yep.
Sugar.
Sugar 6 CRM. So the announcement at WPC was that it is now supported on the Windows Azure platform, which I think is pretty cool. If I recall correctly, Sugar CRM is a PHP application.
That is my understanding as well.
So it would be, I've never used Sugar CRM, but I've heard good things about it.
Yep.
And it's one of those things where now that it's supported, you can go out and get this installed and working with your cloud account. So, awesome.
Very cool to see applications like that make it onto the platform. Another announcement from WPC was the Windows Azure Platform Appliance, or as lots of people have been calling it, Cloud in a Box.
Yep.
Or Windows Azure in a Box. This is the appliance that we'll be giving to partners and to large customers to basically run their own version of Windows Azure and SQL Azure in their data center.
I seem to recall that you had an interview on this by some. It sounded like Walter Cronkite was interviewing you, but
yeah, I think that's what it was. It was credited as Ryan Dunn.
Yeah.
Which, actually, of course, at the beginning of the show, we claimed that's me.
Yeah.
So you're Steve Marks. So
you interviewed yourself.
I interviewed myself. you can watch that interview. There's a link here to the Channel 9 video, which is the two of us talking all about the Windows Azure appliance. So if you didn't get enough of us in today's episode, when you're done, you could just immediately move over to watch that as
yep.
well.
It's a breath-tingling 9-minute video.
Breath-tingling.
Yeah. Spine-tingling.
All right.
Breath-taking, spine-tingling.
So that takes us to another spine-taking, breath-tingling.
Spine-taking. that would be awesome.
It's breath-taking. And all right. Anyway, that brings us to the feature for this week, which is something that we've actually wanted to cover for a little while, and then we finally got our act together.
It was suggested as well.
Yep. It was? Who suggested it?
I believe Samantha J. Billinger from Montana.
Yeah.
She faxed in a request again.
She sent a telegram, actually, I think. I don't, so the request and what we wanted to cover anyway is Silverlight and Windows Azure, how do these things go together? There's a good talk from Mix 2010,
yep.
or Mix 10, as the cool kids call it, by Matt Kerner, and it's called, I think, Windows Azure and Silverlight, A Match Made for the Web.
Wow, that's catchy.
That's a good title, I think. Yeah. It's actually a really good talk. It was very highly rated in Mix. People loved it, and it goes into more detail than we're going to do here. I think what we're going to do is zero in on one of the most interesting combinations, which is really Silverlight and Blob storage.
Yep.
So, of course, you can just run Silverlight in a web app in Windows Azure. Watch Matt's talk for any sort of gotchas about. There's some interesting things about making sure your debug settings are right and stuff, just tooling stuff and other things to think about there. But things get interesting when you really combine services, you know, with Silverlight. And we have a couple examples of that, and maybe we should just pull up one or two of those. One is, of course, something that we talked about just last week. Was it last week's
news
segment? Or 2 weeks ago already.
Yep.
Is this Netflix Pivot thing, which I put together that shows you the Instant Watch movies on Netflix. Let's look for dramas. Okay, so that's that. This application is Silverlight. It's a web roll that serves up some HTML. It's a Silverlight control, which is actually hosted in Blob storage. And then it's a bunch of images and other data that's also in Blob storage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we have another app. Let's pull this one up. Let's go here, grab a sample picture, and try to upload it. Hey, so this basically uses Silverlight to do direct upload from the client to Blob storage.
Correct.
So instead of like your normal kind of upload to an ASP.NET site, then sort of shovels it off to Blob storage. Yeah. This one goes straight to Blob storage.
No proxy involved.
No proxy, right. And so two different kind of things. Also, this Silverlight control is actually part of my ASP.NET application, so it's part of my web role instead of being hosted in storage. So a little bit different, but this one interacts directly with the Blob storage API. The other one is just hosted on Blob storage. Either way, there are a couple things to keep in mind, and I thought we would just talk about those patterns and show and dive into a little bit of the code in this sample, in the Silverlight upload sample, to see how that's done. So I think the first thing we should talk about is actually this decision about where the Silverlight control itself goes, because that's actually one of the simplest things you can do with Blob storage and Silverlight is put your Silverlight zap file in Blob storage. And as I said, I did it differently for these two applications. The thing to keep in mind if you're going to do this, if you're going to put this into Blob storage, is
case sensitivity.
Actually,
that'll bite you.
That wasn't the one I was going for, but actually, that's a really good point. Actually, this is a good point about Blob storage in general, which may surprise people, especially if you're used to IIS as your web server, because IIS is forgiving on case. It's in almost all cases case insensitive in terms of the path. The URL is case insensitive. Blob storage is always case sensitive. So make sure that you've actually named things the way that you're referencing them and that the URL is exactly right and matches in case. So that's a good point. The thing that I was going to say is that when you put the zap file specifically to Silverlight, if you put a Silverlight control on another domain, there are a couple things to remember. And one is that the content type has to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're using IIS and you've sort of set everything up right, you may never worry about this because you'll drop it onto IIS and you'll see the MIME type is just right. If you're using Blob storage to host this, you have to explicitly set the MIME type. And so actually if we open up...
I think one of the big differences between uploading a ZAP file into your package and it being part of your deployment as opposed to putting it in blob storage is obviously around servicing.
Yep.
So as most people know, if you change your package in Windows Azure, you do require another redeploy or an upgrade, something to that effect, in order to get that into it. We have a read-only breakdown of your package. If you put it in blob storage, however, and assuming you keep the naming at least the same, you're going to be able to update or service that ZAP file outside of the regular deployment, and then things will just work. So it is kind of, I would kind of recommend in most cases to put the ZAP file actually in blob storage. There's a few scenarios where it's a Silverlight control that's never going to change, or very, very rarely would ever change, or it's maybe it's not important.
Or it changes with the other, places where you're going to make a change to the Silverlight control and a change to a WCF service that's part of your app. If you want those things to be versioned together correctly.
Or if it's a vendor's control or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So if you got something from Telligent or Infragistics and you're packaging that up, I'd put it in the package because you're not going to service that yourself.
Right.
So
in the Netflix pivot case, I've put the control in blob storage. And so actually probably two things to point out here. One is that this container where I've put the control itself is if we go to the policies, we'll see that it's public read access, mm-hmm. which means that I can just do http://whatever and get a blob directly from there. So that's a thing to watch out for. If you forget to do this, you'll just get authentication errors when you try to load the control. And then within the control, I have my ZAP file. And if we look at the content type for that, you'll see it's application/x-silverlight-app, which mm-hmm. is the exact thing that it needs to be. This is true regardless, but it's especially important in these cross-domain to blob storage thing. You have to set this yourself on the ZAP file. If you're using a tool like the one that I'm using right now, which is the Clumsy Leaf Cloud Explorer, then it's done like this. You right-click properties, whatever. If you're writing code to do it, you need to set the content type before you upload the blob. But you're probably using some sort of tool. Just look there for where the properties are. It's unlikely this property is going to get magically set for you correctly. Some tools do things like, if it's XML, they set it to the right thing. But a ZAP file is unlikely to get automatically set by any tool. So you need to do that, and that'll work. An advantage to doing this is sometimes these ZAP files are a little bit large. This one's, there's not a lot in here, but it's already, it's getting close to a megabyte, and sometimes they're bigger, it depends what's in there. Mm-hmm. And so an advantage of putting it in blob storage is you can turn on the CDN, then you can sort of get sort of much more efficient downloads of that, which means that people who are located far away from your compute instance still get the Silverlight control quickly. And so it's often more important on the Silverlight control than a lot of the other content on your page to get it there. So just like you want to do this for video files or image files or other things like that, move this out of the package, move it into blob storage. The package will be smaller. Then blob storage can handle this directly. The CDN can help. And you get this kind of thing.
That's a good point. You don't want your package blown up.
That's correct.
Too big a size, I mean.
Exactly.
It doesn't actually explode.
Not physically, but, So that's the trade-off, right? I mean, mm-hmm. ZAP file and blob storage, really good for efficiency, good for just quickly servicing
thing, right?
That thing. Turning on the CDN is good, although make sure that you're actually using the CDN. So I think that if we... Oh, no, I'm doing it wrong. There's no cache control header here, which is a bad idea. I should have here. I wonder if I have it on the older version, and I just forgot to add it. Doing it wrong everywhere. So here is what not to do, is to put these things in blob storage, turn on the CDN, expect magic to happen if you haven't set the cache control header. Because without setting the cache control header, that means that there's a good chance the CDN is just going to expire the blob. It's going to come back to blob storage again, every time. In reality, it uses a heuristic to try to avoid a bunch of trips to blob storage. But you want to set it explicitly. So I should have something in here like max age equals, and that will make sure that the
max age equals 5.
Five seconds is the best way to do it. So you want to do that. So put it in blob storage. That lets you take advantage of the CDN. That lets you sort of offload. Now your web app isn't having to serve all these bits all the time. So that actually takes some load off of your server itself, which means you probably need less servers overall for your app. But if you put it with the package, that means you get to service things together. You'll make sure that you're always in sync between the Silverlight control and the rest of the page. That's what I chose to do for the Silverlight upload example. And it was largely an arbitrary reason to do it, but it sort of makes sense. In the Silverlight upload thing, there's a little back and forth between the web app and the control itself around shared access signatures, and so it's kind of a good idea to put those things in lockstep together. Otherwise, you have no way of sort of atomically updating both in the same way. One way you can get around it is do something like I did here, which is make a new Zap file with a different name, and then you make the change in your code that corresponds to that and starts using the new name of the thing. That's a really good idea if you're using the CDN, especially because you don't want people to get the cached. Even if you think, oh, it's only going to take a few minutes, I'm going to do it now, it's the middle of the night. If you've set the cache control headers, which I haven't done, to cache this for a day or two or something, then you're going to see people getting the old Zap file but the new web application and things will break. So it's sort of a good idea if you're doing this to sort of version the blobs as you go too.
Yep.
Okay, so that was that. So one thing that sort of comes out of this is cross-domain access and what do I have to do? And this matters, sort of where you put the Silverlight control matters a lot for this, because that's actually the domain that will count in most cases. So if your Silverlight control wants to read a public blob, for example, so it's just going to do an HTTP GET against it. If the Silverlight control is hosted in blob storage in the same account, then the server name is the same, which means it can do it. Right? If your Silverlight control is hosted with your page, then when it tries to go to blob storage, it's going to fail. The reverse is also true. So if you want to call a WCF service that's part of your application, if you put the Silverlight control in blob storage, it's now homed in a different server name. Which means when you try to access, you know, foo.cloudapp.net/myservice, that will actually fail. And in both cases, client access policy is what you want. So a file called clientaccesspolicy.xml, this is how Silverlight deals with sort of cross-domain issues. You can also use the Flash one, which is called something different. Another XML file.
Yeah.
What is that one called?
It's cross-domain.
Cross-domain policy or cross-domain.xml? It might just be cross-domain.xml. Anyway. We don't use Flash, so we don't know. Silverlight actually recognizes both, so you can do that. I think it's the drive that you put in, like the USB thing.
Oh, yeah, I use that a lot.
So you
then
store stuff. And the file name always has to be crossdomain.xml.
Did not realize I needed that.
That's what it is.
Oh, okay.
So you need that if you're going to do cross-domain things. So yep. it's sort of the inverse of this. If you've got the Silverlight control in blob storage, you need a client access policy in your application if you want to be able to access it. If you have a Silverlight control hosted with your application and you want to make a call to blob storage, then you're going to need a client access policy there.
How do you do that in blob storage, Steve?
I'm glad you asked, Ryan.
I don't think it's possible.
Let's look at one that I have. So in this Silverlight upload, we have a root container. The root container is magic because it's called $root, but the path is just account.blob.core.windows.net/blob name.
Yep.
There's no container in there. And so when I put a client access policy in that location, now we can do something like go to, if this is actually the name of the account, client access policy.xml. And there it is. So see the URL. This is the important part because client access policy.xml always has to be at the
root.
At the root.
Mm-hmm.
So the way to do that in your web application is just put it off of the root, right? The way to do it in blob storage is to use that root container. If you don't know where the root container is or you don't think you have one and it depends on what tool you're using, you can actually just try just sort of right-click, create a container called $root. That's the magic string.
Yeah.
And the $root won't appear in this URL. You'll get it without that. But that's the thing to create if you don't think you have one.
It'll actually work both ways. You can put $root in there as well.
That's true. Let's do that because it's fun. I like to test everything we say here. So there you go. $root.
So you can do it either way. But the other point you want to do is when you create the container for $root, which you're going to have to do in some tool or another, you do want to set, typically you want to set the root container to be public access.
Yep. So the same settings we saw before on that Zap, because Silverlight is just going to, the Silverlight runtime is just going to do http://, you know, it's an HTTP GET against
So doing exactly what that browser
whatever,
did.
Whatever, right? That thing.
Yeah.
So that's a good way to test it because you're doing the exact same thing here. One thing, again, to pay attention to is the content type. So in this case, I've set it to text/XML. I actually think that application/XML is the new text/XML. I've heard that that's sort of the preferred MIME type for XML files. But somebody who really knows what they're talking about.
Yeah, I'd have to go talk to the MIME type gods because I'm just really not that up on it.
I don't know. I found text/XML worked in the browsers I tested. I actually found when I forgot to do this, which I initially did, you get the application/octet stream or something. You get some generic kind of MIME type on this. And I found, I think that IE worked with that, but Chrome didn't, I think, it could have been the other way around.
Wait, what's Chrome?
One or the other. That's that stuff, the metal-looking stuff on your car.
And it works with Silverlight.
Awesome. Yep. It reflects off a kind of silver light.
Gotcha.
So do set the MIME type here, even for the client access policy. Again, remember case sensitivity. It's all lowercase. That's what you want.
I think we can safely say a best practice in most scenarios, especially when you're going to be pulling this out and having a client somewhere read it, is set the content type.
Yeah. When in doubt, set the content type on everything.
It'll never hurt you.
Right.
Right? And it's relatively easy to do. In fact, there's a few methods that people have done, which is when you do the upload, if you're using programmatically uploading, you can do a quick registry lookup by file name extension and put the content type in there. And then if you don't find that content type, then you can use that octet string, which is kind of the default one. You load it up there. And that way you're kind of covered in every scenario.
Right.
And if you don't know how to do that, maybe that's a good blog post we should do, like how to use the registry to look up the content type.
Yeah, I didn't know. That's a good technique. I always have this, like, my own. I know that I upload zip files a lot or whatever, so I have, like, a case statement or whatever. I've never actually used the Windows
It's
mapping
really,
there.
Really simple.
That's a good idea.
I'll share that code.
All right. Ryan is on the hook for that one. So we introduced me as Ryan, so.
Yep, so you're on the hook for it.
That guy is going to do it. So that's client access policy. So if it's in your web app, just drop the XML file in the right place. If you're putting it in blob storage, make sure to put it in the root container. Make sure to set the MIME type. Mm-hmm. And watch out for case sensitivity. Make it all lowercase.
Yes.
One gotcha here is that the URLs in development storage look different.
Yes.
So while in the cloud, it's going to be, you know, foo.blob.core.windows.net/container/blob name, or in the case of root, no container, just the blob name. In development storage, it's 127.0.0.1:10,000/devstore-account1, which is the account name, /container/blob. Yep. Or in the root case, it's /devstore-account1/client-access-policy. Remember, that won't work. If you do that, the Silverlight runtime is going to go to the root of that server. So it's going to go 127.0.0.1:10,000/client-access-policy.xml. That won't work. That doesn't exist. You need an account name in there. So local development storage will return a 404. Silverlight will go, there's no client access policy. I cannot make a cross-domain call to blob storage.
Mm-hmm.
So I just use the cloud storage when I test the Silverlight stuff, I just go straight to cloud storage, create my $root thing, and start just testing directly against that. I think that's probably the thing to do. There's no good workaround that I know of beyond sort of crazy URL rewriting to make this work locally in dev storage. And yes, I've talked to the team about it, and they're looking at ways that we can address that in the future. But for now, we're kind of stuck with it. So that's what I would do, is I would go straight to real cloud storage to do these kind of cross-domain tests. So maybe we should look at, let's look at one little piece of code now that's actually about that client access policy. I think it's here. This is my programmatic code that creates that client access policy that you saw. So I get a reference to the root container. I set the permissions to make it public. I get a reference to a blob within the root container that is client access policy.xml. By the way, look at this little cheat here. Did you know you could do this? I'm not going container.getref, I'm going straight from the top, and if you just put in this as a get blob reference, it does give you the reference to the root container version of that or whatever.
Yeah.
This code would be much clearer if I did get container reference $root get blob reference client access policy.
Yes, that would be.
Hey, that's it's part. I like to make people work at it. When I give out code samples, I don't want it to be too easy. I want them to have to think really hard about why it works. That's my goal. Then look at this. I'm setting the content type to text slash XML, which in retrospect, I think is supposed to be application/XML. And then, as all good developers do, when I create XML, I just type it in by hand. So Ryan was mocking me earlier for this. So here's just the literal string, because it never changes. So I just pasted this directly into the code. One thing to look for is, is it here, I think? There's some subtlety that you should probably look up, but if you're doing cross-protocol, the Silverlight control is on an HTTP page, but the URL you use in Access Blob Storage is an HTTPS URL, which is commonly the case. If you just use the tools, your default connection string will use the HTTPS. Then you have to make sure, I think it's this. I think that, see, in addition to domain URI equals star, which says, hey, this can come from anywhere, I don't care who's calling me, this says, oh, and it's okay if it's from HTTP. And I don't know if I got this exactly right. It does work. I have tested this with HTTPS, I remember sort of struggling with the documentation, the Silverlight documentation around client access policy, to make sure that this was right. So pay attention to that. Also pay attention to allowing the HTTP methods and HTTP request headers. If you're going to use blob storage, you're going to want to be able to do puts and posts and gets and deletes maybe. And request headers, you're going to want all sorts of custom headers.
Well, that brings up another good point, though, right? For security reasons, if you were just using this and you only wanted to do uploads and didn't want people to delete stuff, mm-hmm. you could just disable the delete verb, right? And that way you don't have to worry about someone accidentally finding a vulnerability and tricking in sending a delete.
It's defense in depth, I guess.
Yes.
You can also do similar things with HTTP request headers. This can be like ms-star. And that says, like, okay, or x-ms-star,
right.
which is what most of the important headers for blob storage are,
right.
like public access on, sending access on a container and things like that.
Yeah.
A lot of those start with x-ms. Not everything does that you might, like, content type and whatever. There's some you want to pay attention to, by default, what does Silverlight allow in the request headers and what do you actually need.
Mm-hmm.
Think about this, but I did the lazy thing and just put star for both of these things. So this is it. You can also, of course, use the resource path to restrict to a specific path within blob storage, things like that. So you should take care to do kind of a proper job here of restricting this to just, least privileges, right? What is actually needed for this? But this is code. That's it to create this thing programmatically. And this does the right thing around lowercasing, setting a content type, making sure that it's in the root container and that it's got public read permissions.
Well, I don't know if people realize this. I don't know if we covered it. But one of the things we're talking about here is when you use those verbs and those headers and things like that,
mm-hmm.
that obviously assumes that you're authenticated in most scenarios. And for Silverlight, at least for up till Silverlight 3, the authenticate header was not supported.
Yep.
So there was no way to have the username, the account name and secret key be passed, so you couldn't sign the request. So that turns out to be not really that big of a blocker. There's only like one good scenario where you'd want to do that with a Silverlight client. Anyways, however, what it does mean, though, is that we needed to use a different mechanism here, which was shared access signatures.
Exactly.
If you go back to show number 8.
Wow. Did you just make that up?
No.
Or is that actually the
show?
I think
it's actually show 8.
That's amazing.
You will see that we have an entire show on how shared access signature works.
Yep.
And this is the mechanism that we're using to grant, essentially, to a URL the ability to write to a location. And that way, the Silverlight client never needs to know what the secret key is, because you're giving that down to a client. And also, you can very easily control the permissions. It can be read-only or delete or read and write and delete and those kind of things. So.
Let's show in Fiddler how this all works out. So I'm gonna upload a couple files. I like penguins; they're cute. Okay, so I'm gonna hit upload here, and this is Silverlight uploading directly to Blob Storage. There's that client access policy in effect, which means that I can talk to Blob Storage. But then, as Ryan said, how is it working that you don't have public anonymous upload rights to Blob Storage? So how is that working? Where are those shared access signatures? Look first at in Fiddler, which is my favorite tool for looking at all this stuff. Here's what the request looks like. This is probably hard to read. Is there a good way to... If I do the raw, then I can view Notepad. Okay, so forget all this stuff. Who cares? Here's a put request that's going to slupload.blob.core.windows.net. So that's why the client access policy has to be right here, because that's what it's going to ask for, is that URL plus client access policy.
Mm-hmm.
Here is a container name. I'm just sort of splitting this out as we go. So this is a container name. It's a GUID. Every sample I have has container names that are GUIDs, because it's easy to generate and assume that they're unique. Here's the file name, and that's actually the file that I uploaded. So this is blob name is the better way to say it, but that's the file that I chose to upload. And then here is the query string. And so this has, this is a shared access signature. So go back and watch episode 8, was it, to see all the details about this. But this basically has in it, in the URL itself, it has authorization that says you can go ahead and write to this, and I'll show you in the code in a second where this came from.
Mm-hmm.
But this is why it works. This is how Silverlight is able to do this.
Well,
the client access policy gives us access, and then this this gives it up.
You can see it right there. So you have the SE, which is the end date, the 2007,
yep,
all the way to the ampersand SR, which is the signed resources C, which is the container. So you're saying go ahead and on the permissions are on the container.
Yep.
And then you say sign permission SP equals W,
which is
right. And then you have
the
HMAC signature.
Right. The rest of this is sort of signed.
Pretty straightforward. The only thing is it's going to expire. Obviously, you put, like, I don't know, 10 minutes.
It's a pretty short expiry time. I don't know.
So if you were to copy the signature down, wouldn't work.
Wouldn't work. Exactly. I don't have to fear that everyone's going to do this. It's already going to expire by the time this show is over, let alone by the time you guys all see it. So that's it. So that's how that's working. Let's go back to the code. So we should have, I guess we already did it before I loaded this. There should be somewhere here, there should be a call for the client access policy. And I wonder what it might be cached that we already loaded this application.
You
so probably happened the first time, but
yeah.
Anyway, so that's sort of the sequence, is the zap is coming from the domain itself, from the app itself. And then below it, there should be sort of a request for client access policy, which says, yes, you can do this. And then you'll see the actual put request that put those things using a shared access signature. If we go to the code, we will see that here in page load is where I do all the work of creating the shared access signature. So here's the account. We create Silverlight policy is that method that we just showed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing that every time for no good reason. So every time you load the page, I'm rewriting that XML file.
It's very efficient.
That's efficiency. That's what I like to do. Container name is a GUID. We create the container, and then here you go. That's all the code that's required to generate that shared access signature.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we say the permissions are right, and then we put the expiry time in there. It's 10 minutes. And then we construct the URL, which is basically the container URI. It's actually interesting what I'm doing here. I'm sort of taking the container, sticking the query string on it, and then in the Silverlight control, I'm just jamming in the file name in between.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little bit of a weird way to do it, actually, but it works. So basically, I'm just appending that, because what you get back from this shared access signature is a string, and it's actually the, like, you know, the query parameter that that goes on the end of a request. And so I'm taking that and actually putting that on the page. So I guess if we open default.aspx itself.
I don't know if you know this, but you can use datetime.now. You don't have to use UTC now, because it's actually converted on when it hits the server to universal time.
Okay.
Little.
What do you mean when it hits
trivia.
The server?
When the shared access when the policy goes to get applied. Because the date time now is not in universal time, it's automatically converted to universal time and then applied. So you're always going to see universal
where
time.
Where is it
back.
In the query string? Does it have the,
yeah,
will it say PEST or whatever?
No. It'll because it gets converted to the Zulu time.
But then that's not at the server, because this doesn't actually touch the server. Getting a shared access signature is all local stuff. So it could be that the .NET thing is doing the right thing, which I suspect is true. That it's taking the date time, converting it first, and generating the string. But this is actually pre-hitting
the server. Oh yeah, that's what
server,
you're right. You're right. That is the local code is converting it to UTC.
Yeah,
first.
But I actually believe you're probably right that it's the .NET client library does that first.
I always do
UTC now, because otherwise I'm worried that I'll mess it up somehow. I think you're right that you can do either one.
I was actually thinking of the shared access policy, which do get saved up
yes,
in the server.
Yes, and those get converted.
Right. Okay.
Great. Figured that out. So Here we go. You'll see somewhere here in these init params. There you go. Container URL. That's that one that we made. So that's where it's getting. That's how it's getting passed into the Silverlight client. And this is that example of kind of pairing the Silverlight application with right. the ASP.NET code. If somehow I changed how this worked or I changed the name of this parameter, I'd want to make sure that I version those two things together because I don't want the Silverlight control looking for the wrong parameter. Whatever. So that's kind of the communication. You could also imagine just doing a WCF service or something like that that would fetch on demand a URL. My app actually has this problem that if you load up that page and then you walk away for 10 minutes and you come back and then try to upload something, it just fails. Because it's on page load that it generates the signature and it's only good for 10 minutes. So maybe not the best way to do it, but...
Yep.
But hey, I feel bad about this sample now because that's like the fourth time we've had to like say, yeah, that's really not good. So anyway.
Well, you learn from other people's mistakes.
There yeah, or I learn from my mistakes and so can you.
Way to go, Ryan.
Yeah, so.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good. That's the first time I'm happy to be called Ryan. So yeah, so that's the sort of the shared access signature side of it. Then there's a bunch of code that actually handles the upload. You can go read. I have a 3-part blog series about this. I'm sure we'll link to one part or the other, and then you can kind of go through them.
Yeah.
That talks about how I use the shared access signatures, and then goes into the detail of how does the Silverlight it actually does put block and you know it does block uploads and right. whatever things like that. Kind of cool and shows you how to get started using Silverlight against blob storage. So I'll check that out for the details on that. But this is sort of the general, you know, how do you set these things up so that they work correctly together.
Yep.
And then I have one more thing I wanted to show about this that's really quick, and then I think we can move on.
Okay.
Which is I wanted to show something in the Netflix viewer. So it's surprising, but this button, so I click view this movie on Netflix. I'm not going to do it because I'm logged in to Netflix. Who knows what's... I don't know. Is there any secret information that shows up? I'm scared to do it. If I click this button,
okay.
It would navigate in the browser. So it would actually take me to the Netflix page for this movie, and then I could hit back and come back here, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That actually lets you run into a cross-domain issue just with that, because the permissions to the HTML page to do things like browse to another page or manipulate the DOM or something like that. Are different if you're doing it cross-domain. So if you have a ZAP file, a Silverlight application hosted on a different domain, and you want to be able to do this sort of thing, there's one more thing you have to do, which if we view source here, we can see. Which is, where is it? Right here, sort of in the middle of the screen now. Enable HTML access value equals true.
Uh-huh.
That's what you have to set to basically grant permission for this foreign ZAP file that's coming from another domain to manipulate this browser window and this HTML page.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I had to do because the ZAP file is hosted in blob storage. That's what I had to do to make sure that I could actually browse. So just a gotcha that I wanted to throw out there in case people run into that. All right.
Very cool.
I think it's that time.
It is that time. It's time for the tip. The tip of the week.
Yes. And that means it's time for us to tell our fabulous editor, Bob, what to use as sort of an introduction to the tip of the week.
I think I have it.
All right.
The tip has to do with Fiddler.
Yep.
And everyone knows Steve's favorite movie is Fiddler on the Roof.
Absolutely.
So I
favorite
think,
musical, even.
Yeah.
Not just the movie, but...
Musical of all time. Steve will actually belt out a few tunes here shortly. So I would like it if we could see a movie poster, perhaps, or scene from the movie in which Steve and I are starring in our favorite musical slash movie.
Fantastic. That's a good way to introduce the tip of the week. So with that, here's your tip of the week.
If I were a rich man, all day long I biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man.
I love it.
All right.
That's,
I hope you have a beard.
Fantastic musical. I assume I would. So Fiddler, this has to do, we've been looking at Fiddler to see all these things going on, how we're interacting with blob storage, what the authorization header is, things like that. It's even a good way to find out when things are going wrong because the authorization is wrong or something like that, right. You get some nice information in the XML that comes back from the server that is otherwise sort of you have to extract through code, and it's kind of a pain. It's really easy to see in Fiddler.
Yeah.
Fiddler is fantastic. I should use it all the time when I use blob storage, but if you do this when you're running against local development storage, you will encounter an issue which is familiar to a lot of people who've used Fiddler for a lot of reasons, which is that when you go to that loopback address, when you do localhost, that actually often bypasses the Fiddler proxy. And so unless you've done something extraordinary to work around that, that's what you'll get. You'll be hitting 127.0.0.1. That'll just go straight past Fiddler and go short circuit on the loopback address, and you won't see anything in Fiddler relating to that traffic to development storage. So that is bad. How do I fix it, you might ask?
You can't. End of the tip of the week.
Tip of the week is you are in trouble.
Okay.
So if you want to contact us on Twitter, there is a way to fix it. I can't believe you doubted us. Here's a blog post that we will link to that talks about the that basically talks about connection strings and development storage and what is actually the syntax, what goes in there, what doesn't. And it's got an example of how you can do Fiddler. Zoom it. And you'll see there, so it's development storage equals, use development storage equals true, which is your normal kind of how to use development storage. And then there's this development storage proxy URI equals http://ipv4.fiddler. And ipv4.fiddler is this magic host name that Fiddler makes up so that you can hit that. Fiddler intercepts it correctly, then it actually turns around
forwards
and does its local host.
Right. Yep.
So that's what you need to do. Then you'll capture all of that traffic in Fiddler, and it takes care of it. So this blog post is interesting also because it's got some other stuff about how you might set up custom endpoints or even configure a shared access signature in your connection string, which I thought was actually kind of cool. Didn't know you could do that. So that's how you can do that.
Well, it was great. Good tip. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.
And if you want to get in touch with us on the show, and a few people have through the comments and given us some great show ideas, and to the listeners out there who find the term leasing a blob funny, we'll say it a few more times. Lisa Blob, Lisa Blob.
Lisa Blob.
Blob.
Lisa Blob.
With
Lisa
that, Blob. If you want.
Lisa
Blob.
Lisa. First name Lisa, last name Blob.
Yeah. If you want to get in touch with us, contact us at Cloud Cover Show on Twitter.
Yep.
And go through the forums however you want and let us know what you want to see.
Yep.
With that, thanks.
Thanks.